You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 5th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sarah Chase on corruption in America and what is at stake. Meanwhile, all eyes on Georgia, as Joe Biden provides at least 2,000 reasons to give Dems control of the Senate. L.A. County hospitals are in crisis as paramedics are told not to transport COVID patients who have a low chance of survival. Will he or won't he? Mike Pence in the hot seat as Republican senators vote tomorrow in an attempt to overthrow the election results. Meanwhile, progressives seek an 11th hour impeachment over Trump's Georgia call. And the U.S. will stick with a two-dose regime of vaccinations, though most of those vaccine doses are now sitting idle. And a day out from Trump's Proud Boy rally in D.C., one of the Proud Boy leaders are arrested for lighting a historic black church's Black Lives Matter banner on fire. In the wake of California's Proposition 22, Vons and Pavilions markets fire essential workers and replace them with contractors. Trump's EPA takes a final aim at health studies in a last attempt to cripple environmental regulations. And lastly, DOJ claims that the census data has hit a snafu and will miss its statutory deadline. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Sam. I'm doing well. And yourself?
I'm hanging in there. I am very. I'm a little anxious about Georgia, to be honest with you. The stakes obviously are huge. We have exceptionally high turnout at this point. My understanding is turnout is 23% lower than it was in the November election, relatively speaking. But this is a special election, and that's still pretty amazing. And the November election was had an enormous turnout. So there's a lot of enthusiasm there. There's also about over 100,000 people now, 112,000 voters who did not vote in the 2020 general election, who are voting, who have voted in this election so far.
Yeah. So it's around 3 million early votes cast, and that's 40% of registered voters in Georgia already.
And that's, I mean, you know, look, there's indications that there's been, increased, turnout amongst younger people and amongst, African Americans. Very hard to read these tea leaves.
I know. I mean, these all sound like positive signs, but once again, we've been here before where we're talking about these wonderful signs for the Democrats. And what do you know? The Republican Party stronghold stands firm. And yep. Now you have Trump going to Georgia, which I know we'll talk about, but Loeffler's promising, oh, I'll contest the election results. Could rile up the base. We'll see. It might be too late, though. Again, we just don't know.
We don't know. But what was very interesting was that Joe Biden was in Georgia last night. And the reporting over the past couple of weeks was that Joe Biden was basically telling Democrats in the House in particular to prior to Donald Trump coming out and saying he wanted $2,000 checks, that Joe Biden has basically been saying, you know, sort of back off this a little bit. However, Donald Trump provided an opening. Nancy Pelosi, to her credit, took it. They could have just stopped at attempting unanimous consent, but they pushed it all the way to a vote. They had to suspend the rules because it was a change in regular order. And they passed it. They sent it to the Senate. Mitch McConnell killed it, even though Loeffler and Perdue had come out and said they were now for it because they had been being hammered by John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock in this race. And Joe Biden, yesterday in Georgia, essentially just laid it right on the line. He said that despite the fact that Loeffler and Perdue might want it, you're not going to get it if Mitch McConnell maintains control of the Senate. Here's Joe Biden.
One state can chart the course, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next generation. By electing John and the Reverend, you can make an immediate difference in your own lives, the lives of the people all across this country, because their election will put an end to the block in Washington on that $2,000 stimulus check, that money that will go out the door immediately to help people who are in real trouble. Think about what it will mean to your lives, putting food on the table, paying rent, paying for your mortgage, paying down the credit card, paying the phone bill, the gas bill, the electric bill. Just look around. Millions of people in this country out of work through no fault of their own. No fault of their own. They're struggling. Many are fearful, and many have given up hope. Look at the lines at food banks. Hours and hours and hours. This is the United States of America, for God's sake. And their food lines, like we've not seen since the Depression. And they're getting longer. Families, children, people have worked their whole lives and never asked for a thing except a fighting chance. Now, they're lining up for food in America. And the debate over $2,000 isn't some abstract debate in Washington. It's about real lives. Your lives, the lives of good, hardworking Americans. And if you're like millions of Americans all across this country, you need the money, you need the help, and you need it now. Look, Georgia, there's no one in America with more power to make that happen than you, the citizens of Atlanta, the citizens of Georgia.
I mean, it's... I have some issues with the rhetoric. We'll take that in a second. But, the reality is that, I think it's easy to overestimate what can happen if the Democrats take the Senate, because you still have folks like, Joe Manchin and would-be Joe Manchins who are going to, place themselves right in the middle of these two, parties. And make sure that everything has to go through them, and they'll be a little bit skimpy about stuff. That's the way they get attention. But the fact is that Joe Biden laid it out there with the $2,000. Obviously, there's going to be a lot more that comes with allowing for a Democratic Senate, but that makes it very, very simple. And that's pretty compelling. Now, that said, I don't necessarily appreciate the idea that, you know, no fault of their own, because it sets up a dynamic that very often, or maybe, you know, sometimes or in normal times, if people lose their jobs, it's a fault of their own. Or if they're living in poverty, it's a fault of their own, as opposed to structural things. In fact, our guest is going to talk about that, I suspect, today, that lead to that. But as a campaign pitch, as a last day, as a closing argument, that's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, and I actually think it's fairly well suited for Georgia there. I mean, he's an old school kind of Democrat, and typically southern states like that have churned out Democrats who espouse similar rhetoric here. I mean, you know, Ossoff, for example, he's not Bernie Sanders. So I was pleasantly surprised by this. I hope he did talk to Joe Manchin and the other centrist Democrats who are going to try to be kingmakers in this instance, but it's not just the right strategy, or it's not just the right policy, because it's simple and it gets relief to people quickly and easily. But it's also the right move strategically. And I think this goes against a lot of Biden's inclinations to be more centrist, means testy. But this policy has shown, and stimulus checks have shown, to be so popular. They gave Trump a boon in a way that I think Democrats underestimated going into the November election. And larger checks would help Democrats long term. So even if they're just thinking in a self-interested manner, it's the right thing to do. And Biden should be pushing for this. We'll see what happens if both Democrats win and both those seats turn blue. This could not happen, and then they face a whole different set of problems.
I'm not convinced it's not consistent with Biden, because I don't think that Biden has that strong of an ideological perspective. I think he saw the House vote overwhelmingly for this, and he likes to put himself right in the middle, regardless of where that is. And so the point that I think it shows us on some level is that if there is an ability to push our politics to the left, he is going to go, he is not going to swim against that tide. He is going to land right in the middle of wherever the argument is. And if you have overwhelming support from a Democratic House on an issue, he will move to place himself a certain distance, you know, relative. He's always going to keep himself.
I think there's a caveat if that movement helps Democrats, the Democratic Party as a whole electorally. I think that's key to his shift on this issue, because they are convinced that it hinges, the Senate runoffs.
I think that's true too. Meanwhile, here is Donald Trump. He was in Georgia yesterday, and he was ostensibly there to promote the Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. David Perdue, I think, is still in quarantine because of COVID. Kelly Loeffler got up on stage with him and promised that she would vote to overturn the election results for president, which is her last ditch cynical attempt to get some votes there. But here's Donald Trump saying ostensibly vote for Loeffler and Perdue, but really unsurprisingly making it about Donald Trump.
Nothing and no one will be able to stop them. The Senate seats are truly the last line of defense. Now, I must preface that by saying, because they'll say, he just conceded. No, I don't concede. So, Kelly, if I might add, I think we're going to win, in which case we'll be the last line of defense. It's called veto.
I love that so much. He undercuts.
Totally undercut the whole reason why he was there.
He's not like, that anyone's really paying attention, but it's like, she's the last line of defense, except we're actually going to win the election, so I'm the last line of defense, so who really cares?
We don't really need her. In fact, let me explain to you why we don't need Kelly Loeffler there, because I'm going to veto. There you go. And so Donald Trump, I mean, look, let's put it this way. If Warnock and Ossoff win these races, there are two reasons. One is because of the organizing that has taken place over the past couple of years, really leading up to Stacey Abrams' loss, in quotes, to Brian Kemp, and I think her showing, which continued the organizing and continued, like, gave people a sense of, like, wow, we can actually do this in Georgia. That's reason number one. And reason number two has to be Donald Trump fractured this party and sent a mixed message and may have depressed the voter turnout. But we will see tonight. We will cover that. And in a moment, we're going to be talking to Sarah Chase on her most recent book on corruption in America. What is at stake? In the meantime, now I have to say, like, I have this problem with my daughter. It's a little embarrassing, but I have to remind actually both my kids, keep the door shut when you go to the bathroom.
Ah,
yeah, that's pleasant.
I'm sure she appreciates it.
Yes. Said. Well, most normal people shut the door when they go to the bathroom. So why would you let people look in on you when you go online? Using the internet without ExpressVPN, it is like going to the bathroom with the door open. And believe me, that is distasteful. Your internet service provider, and I think you know this, Emma, knows every single website you visit.
Yes.
I realized this when I got fiber in, and I was talking to one of the tech people. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I can see you're connected now. Yeah, go to, oh, I just saw you. And I'm like, what? What?
Not good.
No. What's worse, they can sell this information to ad companies and tech giants who's going to use your data to target you. ExpressVPN creates a secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so the online activity cannot be seen by anybody. It works on all your devices. You can put it on your phone. I got it on my laptops. You can even have it on your routers so everyone who shares your Wi-Fi can still be protected even if they don't have ExpressVPN. So we can do that for the whole family. Just fire up the app. You click one button, you're protected. ExpressVPN is the world's number one rated VPN by CNET, by Wired, by The Verge, countless others.
Wow.
Yep. It's pretty awesome. And I will say this. It also, I mean, you can watch some shows in some other countries. This VPN is, most of my experience is with ExpressVPN, but I can tell you it's super easy. I thought it was some type of like hodgepodge. You put the app on, you click it, boom, you're done. So if you're like me and you want to keep your online activity your own business, secure yourself by visiting expressvpn.com/majority today. Use my exclusive link, expressvpn, expressvpn.com/majority. You can get an extra 3 months free. That's expressvpn.com/majority. Also, I've talked about this in the past. Back in the day, I was very reluctant to use any type of deodorant because I didn't want to have all that stuff that is in deodorants and
aluminum, all that kind of garbage.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Did not want that. Then, of course, I became single again and I decided maybe it's time for me to pick that up. And fortunately, there was an antiperspirant there for me, and that was Native. It is made of ingredients that you have heard of, things like coconut oil, shea butter, has no aluminum, no parabens, no talc. And also for me, what I like, they have one that's unscented, and that's the one that I use because I don't like
to smell like yourself.
I don't like any smells. I don't want anything to smell.
What about apples?
I like apples. I like the smell of apples. If they had apples, I would probably do apples, but floral things I can't handle. It's just I get allergic to it, but that's not the point. They have over 10 scents for people who do like smell, and they have, like I say, they have unscented, which is they don't call it the Sam Cedar, but that's what they should. Native's classic scents include coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose. I cannot go near the lavender. I'm sorry, folks. Cucumber and mint I've tried, actually, and that's okay. I like that one. And citrus and herbal musk. Like I say, they also have the unscented option, and they have a sensitive collection that's made without baking soda. If one of your New Year's resolutions is to cut down on your plastic consumption, Native now offers a line of plastic-free deodorants in their most popular scents. There's a reason why Native has over 16,000 five-star reviews, and it's because it works. Get free shipping on every order, plus 30-day free returns and exchanges in the U.S. You can make the switch to Native today by going to Native.com/majority report or use the code promo code majority report at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. That's Native.com/majority report. Use the promo code majority report at checkout for 20% off your first order. And lastly, folks who also know me know that I'm very much a creature of habit. I don't like to have to think about anything. So I get in ruts occasionally where I wear the same pants. And as you can see, I have a very narrow rotation of shirts. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to do any thinking. That's why I like. I don't, the stuff I have to do every day or normal course of whatever, I don't want to think about it. And that is why Honey makes my life just a tiny bit easier. I'm also obsessed about finding coupons online because I don't like to pay full price for anything. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, I get it.
And I sat my daughter down. I was like, showed her. Well, it is so much easier now because all you need to do is add Honey to your browser for free and you can shop on all your favorite websites like normal. If Honey finds a coupon, it will automatically tell you as you're going to check out It applies the correct codes, drops the price at the price in a flash. You don't have to think. You don't have to remember. You don't have to search. It's just completely automated. It's already found $1 billion in savings automatically. Honey is literally a no-brainer, and that's why I like it.
It's
just
great.
A few seconds. It's super easy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, that's the thing. It's not even easy. You do it once and you never even think
about
it.
I have it as a plugin on Google Chrome and it just checks as I check out.
I saved, I don't remember how much it was, a couple of bucks on just, you know, I had to get a pair of headphones for Saul, you know, so he could listen to his iPad and not have to bother me.
I got my mom a nice sweater for Christmas. I saved like $25.
Really?
It was like,
that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Try Honey today at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. And lastly, folks, got an email from a longtime fan and listener, Megan, whose husband, Jeff, is a therapist working in the ICU at a major hospital here in New York City. Folks, the folks who are working in these hospitals, I mean, in addition, of course, to all the people who are essential workers who are working at the grocery stores, who are delivering your packages, but obviously our medical folks have been just, I mean, really, they've been heroic in the efforts they're putting out. Well, it's his birthday, and so shout out to Jeff. Happy birthday. We'll give you one of these. Thank you for the work you're doing, Jeff. And also, your wife wants to remind you to please wash your beloved Left is Best Majority Report sweatshirt. It's due for a launderer. All right.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right. Want to welcome to the program Sarah Chase, author of On Corruption in America, What is at Stake? Do we have Sarah?
She's joining now, it looks like.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on your latest book. Like I say, On Corruption in America, What's at Stake? It is a very broad look at corruption. Not just, I think, ultimately leading up to America, but it's sort of the existence of it. And I want to start where you more or less start, and we'll circle back to how you got back to America. But this is with King Midas,
huh.
And Anatolia, which for most people, I'm not sure they remember where Anatolia is back in 600 BC, but it was part of the Persian Empire, I guess, located, I guess, more or less.
It's basically where modern Turkey is.
Right.
And in fact, it was in this sort of cultural in-between place. It was largely inhabited by Greeks. So it's in this cultural in-between place between Persian and sort of more Eastern and Greek culture. And I'm thrilled that you started there, because it's not every book on corruption in America that is going to plunge people into, you know, 6th century BC mythology, right?
I don't know if there's any other book.
And just to reassure anyone who might want to read this book, it, you know, it's not like I try to do an entire history of corruption from 600 BC until today. I've selected specific moments, both in sacred stories and then in American history, but a particular time in American history that I find are particularly emblematic and instructive. And so this really is about money. What I found that was so astonishing. So Midas, you know, this is the guy with the golden touch, right? You know, so he gives a god a gift, or he does something for a god who says you can have one gift, and he says, I want everything I touch to turn to gold. And it takes him about, what, 37 seconds to realize, bad idea. And it's usually told as a just straight up story about greed. What I found in looking at the archaeology of Anatolia is that, in fact, there was a Midas, and he lived just about where and when money as an instrument was invented. It's actually a myth about money, which is a revolutionary new way at the time of storing and transferring value. And what's most critical about it to the issue of corruption is that unlike other modes of storing value, which are very bulky, you know, and therefore really only kings can hoard it, or you have to take care of it, like it's sheep and it's fig trees and things like that, and you have to lavish care and attention on it. Money, you know, there's like no finish line. Once money becomes the measure of social standing, there's no such thing as enough anymore, because, hey, Sam, you got, what is the Forbes, you know, say for you? It says 1.2 billion. Okay, well, I need 1.5 billion. And then you need one, you know, 7.8 billion and, you know, whatever. I mean, it becomes this race with no finish line to do what? And this is back to the Midas myth. He touches an apple, it turns into gold. He touches his daughter, she turns into gold. Meaning, you're transforming everything of intrinsic, irreplaceable value into money. Once a society turns itself over to people with the Midas disease, corruption is inevitable.
And, I mean, and that is... I guess that is almost, I mean, the corruption's inevitable just from the development of this idea of, I guess, on some level of commodification, but to have a sort of a commodification that is almost sort of like not necessarily tangible. I mean, money is tangible, of course, but
No, you're exactly right.
And it also, it occurs to me that as a mechanism of fueling conquest, right? And to provide for, you know, as soldiers get this script and those that they conquer must, essentially they have to pay back to their conquerors in tax what the soldiers provide for them. That's what creates the value. But there's also intrinsically a power dynamic that is created just in the existence of the money. Right? I mean,
yes. I mean, once your society is monetized, the person who, so the paradox of money is when it first makes its appearance in a society in bulk, it actually has a democratizing effect because it cuts against, you know, hierarchies that are based on bloodlines or conquest or whatever. So when money first hits, be it in ancient Greece, so there's a real connection between the great Athenian democracy and the arrival of money from Anatolia, you know, and similarly in the Netherlands, when the Spanish were hauling all of this silver out of Latin America at, as you suggest, irreparable cost to human societies and landscapes. But in the Netherlands, it resulted in a real democracy that really laid the foundations of ours. And similarly, around the time of the American Revolution, there wasn't enough specie, so we started printing paper money. The problem is, once money becomes the mark of social standing, then you have new aristocracies or new elites that build themselves around the hoarding of this money and, as you suggest, the conversion of everything. And export ends up being a really important aspect of that because you're monetized. So, for example, we don't need to go too deep down this rabbit hole, but you know, the Spanish found all of this gold and silver in, you know, south of here. The English didn't find much of that. And so, but what did they convert into gold? They converted whale oil. They converted beaver skins. They converted, you know, and so you have bison, you know, so you have the extermination of these natural resources because they're being converted to gold. And now the United States is in a very similar situation with fossil fuels, where we are, I'm speaking to you from the state of West Virginia that has been basically penetrated, if you will, by multiple pipelines over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. And that's all about export. It's not about, you know, West Virginia getting to even burn any of this gas. It's all about, so once you're exporting fossil fuels, there's no finish line. There's no end to that market. And so anyway, I mean, these are some of the issues that arise. And the point is, once you have groups of people who are sick with the Midas disease and are competing over hoarding money, they are going to rig the system to allow, even though they're rivals amongst each other, they unite to rig the system to allow members of their networks, even rival members, to exploit these resources, and resources including human beings, human creativity, human labor, what have you.
Okay, there's a lot that brings up, and I want to circle back to that. I want to go a little bit forward in time as to your motivation in writing this. You have studied corruption in Afghanistan. Obviously, you were there for nearly a decade, and in Nigeria and Uzbekistan, and your attention turned to America because of the former governor from Virginia. Explain that and how you it occurred to you to apply those sort of lessons you had learned, and it became clear that this was an issue for America as well.
Let's say that was already building to some extent as I came to understand the magnitude of the 2008 meltdown, but you are exactly right that it was the Supreme Court decision in the corruption case of former Governor Bob McDonnell that made me realize now, not tomorrow, now you have to start working on this. Because, so this is a guy, I mean, just classic textbook corruption where, you know, a businessman who's like a tobacco guy turned pharmaceutical, right? Who had cooked up some kind of pills that are tobacco based that needed, you know, clinical trials, right? In order to really be marketable. Or, for example, if they could be listed in the Virginia list of what Virginia public servants would get reimbursed for, you know, he was looking for ways of breaking into the market with this thing. So he gives the governor all kinds of stuff, you know, I mean, about 180, not even that much, you know, he was a cheap date, $180,000 worth of loans and gifts and rides and Ferraris and whatnot. And the governor did everything he could, you know, for this guy. He instructed his, you know, head of Department of Education, you know, to try to run the trials. He threw a party where the businessman could dole out $10,000 checks so people could apply for grants. You know, I mean, it was as straightforward as you could ask for. So the governor gets convicted. He appeals. The conviction is upheld unanimously on appeal. And then he appeals it to the Supreme Court. And the decision comes down in the summer of 2016 when, you know, the electoral campaign is in full swing. I have to say, if the Supreme Court had just overturned it, I wouldn't have been wildly shocked. What wildly shocked me was that the Supreme Court overturned the decision 8-0.
Right.
8-0. And the argument was that basically this is politics, and that if this were upheld, you know, much of politics in Washington would be prosecutable, and that in fact it right, exactly. I'm looking at your expression, and that's, it's like, yeah, and, you know, I mean, right. And what was fascinating was the contention that the United States had more to fear from prosecutorial overreach in corruption cases than it does from corruption itself. I mean, my jaw was, you know, skittering across the floor someplace. And this was, you know, weeks before Trump started with his, you know, rigged system. Right. It was while Bernie Sanders was making a pretty cogent case about political corruption. And between the two of them, and I'm not making a comparison here, but between the two of them, who were both seen as complete outsider candidates, they certainly amassed, you know, a majority of American voters. So corruption within weeks of that decision upended the U.S. political system.
Right. And then, of course, this also, you know, falls in line with Citizens United, where there was just this complete refusal to acknowledge the idea of even like things can appear to be corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. But all right. So you argue that that corruption is on a continuum, but there are moments in time, particularly in the context of this country, where it becomes something that is qualitatively different, that it's not just a matter of there being more corruption or less corruption, an ebb and a flow, but there is a moment where you cross a threshold where something fundamentally changes. And you specifically look at the Gilded Age from, I don't know, about 1870-ish to, I guess, up until like 1930-ish. Talk about what it is I want to talk about the Gilded Age, but what it is that changes it from a quantitative amount of corruption to a qualitative change in our society.
That's a great way of putting it, which I didn't use those words, and so I thank you for that. It's exactly – so the distinction, I would say, is between corruption being an occasional venal act by an individual public official and or, you know, a couple of friends or whatever, even a lot of those. That's one side of the line. The other side of the line is when corruption becomes – if you will, the operating system. And the operating system deployed by, and this is an idea that a lot of people have, you know, balk at a little bit, so bear with me, but by networks. Now, these networks can be dynamic, they can be shifting, they can be beset by internal rivalries, but fundamentally they are networks that are operating for the enrichment of their members. And there are a couple of really key aspects to this. One is the networks span every possible social and economic divide you can imagine, meaning you have members, you know, public officials and business people, often out and out criminals, often violent, you know, terrorists or violent gangs. So if you will, there are kind of four strands to these things. They also cut across the primary identity divides in a society. And that's part of what makes them so difficult to uproot, because they are welded across the political divides, the sectarian divides, the, you know, race divides, which they then instrumentalize. They then turn around and use those same divides as a way of splitting up the potential majority indignant population challenge to them. Another point to make, so then two other sort of corollaries to that. What that means is lopping off, so I use in the book the Hydra, the metaphor of the Hydra in On Corruption in America to represent this, because you lop off one head of these networks and they reconfigure. You know, I mean, it just knocking off the top guy, and it's happened around the world half a dozen times in the last half a dozen years, at least. And very often the networks reconfigure and remain in power. Secondly, it suggests a different way of understanding corruption, because what I just described with Bob McDonnell is how most Americans think of corruption, which is to say, you know, venal guy gives venal official some stuff in return for which venal official does something for the venal guy. Or you have venal official simply helping him or herself out of the public kitty, or diverting a public contract to a pal who then kicks part of it back. That's how we understand corruption. When you're talking about networks, the actions of people, of network members in public office, are often much less directly quid pro quo than that. Their actions often have to do with bending or repurposing or even crippling state powers, state functions, government agencies, government institutions in ways that will benefit the network as a whole, or certain segments of the network, with the hope of return sometime later. But it's not going to be this direct quid pro quo kind of thing. Or maybe they will have gotten a favor beforehand, or maybe it's going to be their kid or friends. Do you see what I mean? Like, the favors are
ambiance, as much as it is a specific return. It's creating an environment where returns are likely.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's a kind of tissue of reciprocal things where the timing of the quid and the quo are often distant or indirect.
I mean, the point, though, is that, I'm just interjecting here to say that, like, this court framework, what has been set up in the past multiple decades of case law is that quid pro quo is the only standard with which you can measure corruption, unless it's also the appearance of corruption. But based on what you're talking about, they barely see anything as corruption. I mean, the idea that prosecution of corruption is too prevalent and is going to be abused isn't anywhere close to the reality because of what we're discussing right now.
That's exactly right, Emma. In other words, and it's something I chart in On Corruption in America, is an actual deliberate campaign to narrow the legal definition of corruption while the phenomenon itself is exploding. So that definitely, just like Citizens United, was the result of a deliberate campaign. The public corruption interpretations also.
Buckley v. Valeo. I mean, it's been narrowing for many decades. So.
That's right. And that was the other thing that struck me when that opinion came down, was the huge divergence between public understanding of what corruption is, what systemic corruption. So let's go back to what Sam has been driving at, that we're in a moment now, like we were in the Gilded Age, where corruption is the operating system in the United States. And most Americans get that, frankly. Who doesn't is the elites. So the elites are clinging, people like the justices. I'm not saying that they are actively members of kleptocratic networks, but they certainly have adopted the mindset that has been instilled by kleptocratic networks as to what the definition of corruption is. And the divergence between the two understandings is such that when I looked at developing countries where the divergence was this significant, very frequently some kind of explosion resulted, either a violent insurgency or an uprising or, you know, some kind of pretty dramatic explosion. One could argue that the election of 2016 was that explosion for the United States.
Or there's more to come.
Or there's more to come. That's right.
And we should say that, you know, what you're talking about in terms of this sort of environment, this environment that's created, is in part why people look at the Janet Yellen's buckraking with her speeches over the course of a couple of years and making millions of dollars by speaking to these folks, or whether it was with Clinton and her speeches, that there is a sense that, like, there's not necessarily a quid pro quo here, but there is, like, we're in one environment where we have a distinct set of rules which allows for a certain latitude, and then everybody else is in a different environment, essentially. Let me ask you this. These networks which are created, do they always exist, or how conscious do they replicate and strengthen? So we're coming out of the Civil War. We're in Reconstruction at this point, and there's a lot of other things that are going on. We're, like, literally reconstructing as well. And is there a vacuum in which these networks flourish and become stronger? Or is there a self-consciousness? Like, why? Because you bring this back in that, you know, starting with Reagan in many respects, and leading up even from the Powell memo, et cetera, that we're we're headed into another Gilded Age, and there's
definitely
how self-conscious is that, or is it simply that there's always pressure, and then when there's a slight vacuum or an opening, that pressure just sort of fills and starts to take over?
It's a really interesting question and a very important question, and I can't definitively answer it, but I think there are some pretty important markers. One is the degree to which these networks intermarry. That suggests a certain deliberateness of purpose. They intermarry.
Literally intermarry.
Yes. Okay. Yes. They literally intermarry. Also, in the Gilded Age, they were sitting on each other's boards of directors. So even where you didn't have officially a trust, you know, the companies were interlocking. So interlocking boards of directors is another really interesting example. And then the deliberate placement of network members in positions of governmental power. So the most obvious example was the lawyer for the railroads, who becomes attorney general in the midst of all the railroad strikes. And he is then, as attorney general, deploying both court orders and the U.S. Army against striking rail workers.
So, to update it today, literally today, when we see, you know, the general counsel for Uber becoming, you know, getting into the administration, or when we see, the Clintons and the Trumps at a wedding, you know, 8 years ago or whatever it is, that they're best friends. I mean, these are all parts of this type of interlocking. I mean, it's funny because, Matt, our producer, has me watching, The Last Kingdom, and it's just reminiscent.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to take my daughter is going to marry your son, and boom, that's the way that we're going to create these networks. On some level, that's still
it's power and resources. So yes, and I think obviously the Trump administration was, you know, kind of took this to a breathtaking extreme, but I'm glad that you bring in all of the Democratic Party examples. The other one is the nominee to be Secretary of Agriculture, who comes straight out of Big Dairy. So that means we're not going to be changing the subsidy formula to benefit actual small farmers and actual regenerative agriculture. It means that the giants, you know, the Tysons and folks like that, who basically reduce American farmers to indentured servants, are gonna, you know, or even you have John Kerry, who is to be the climate guy in the White House. What was his first stop? What was his first meeting? It was with the oil giants. Why? To find out, quote, what they need and what's possible. Oh, great. So they're the ones who are gonna be, you know, it's just the orientation. And, another important one I think was Holder and Lanny Breuer,
right,
under Obama in the Department of Justice, who had been representing major banks, or at least they were part of the firm that was
foregone conclusion that there were people who were so important, literally individuals, because of their position, were so important to our economy that we could not jail them in any way. And you do, you cite Bill Black in your book, and, we used to have him on quite a bit in the wake of the financial crisis. All right. Well, let me ask you this, because I want to get to.
Can I just sorry to interrupt you, but just to bring forward the purposeful aspect of this. You mentioned the Powell memo. I want to say that where we are currently now is also quite clearly the result of a deliberate campaign whose blueprint was written by Lewis Powell, who went on to become a Supreme Court justice. And in fact, as part of the memo, he basically instructed the Chamber of Commerce how to bring cases that he could, you know, decide in favor of big businesses. But big businesses, that's too abstract. As you suggest, they're individuals. You know, we're talking business executives. Businesses have no agency themselves. We're talking the executives of major businesses. And he laid out a quite detailed formula that involved taking over parts of universities. It involved creating something like the Federalist Society, which busied itself, right, in peopling, you know, the benches of federal courts. It also, part of that blueprint, frankly, was disinformation campaigns, starting with sugar, about how, you know, fat is much worse for us than sugar is. Turns out sugar's just as bad. Tobacco, and then opioids. So a lot of the processes that we've seen playing out were really quite precisely mapped out and then executed by a network, you know, partly of people who are considered off-center libertarians like the Koch brothers, but also by blue chip companies in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce across the political divide.
Let me ask you this. Why is the critique not one of capitalism per se?
Because capitalism, the shape of capitalism depends on the rules. I am a resident of France. France is a capitalist country. However, it is a much more equal country. And there's plenty of corruption in France too. And one could argue that there, you know, to some aspects of it are systemic. But the outcomes for ordinary people are a lot better in France than they are here, including education, including healthcare, including basically leisure to be a human being, including the quality of the food they eat, including environmental impact, you kind of name it. They export a lot of their corruption. But what I'm saying is that capitalism, that's a very general... I don't even know what capitalism means, frankly, because there are so many sub-rules that define the shape of capitalism and that existed in a certain way, you know, between about 1935 and about 1980 in the United States, and then were deliberately dismantled. So was America a capitalist country in 1950? Is it a capitalist country today? Well, I think the answer would be yes in both cases. But arguably in 1950, or let's say 1970, arguably in 1970, that capitalism as constrained by, for example, robust antitrust enforcement, the beginnings of environmental and consumer protections, expanding rights and space, public space for previously disadvantaged groups, you know, that trajectory under capitalism was a much more, I think, beneficial to everybody trajectory than the one we're on now.
Can you have this level, this specific problem of this type of corruption, like reaching this level where it becomes almost a different thing than the sort of the petty corruption in the context of what you would perceive a socialist country?
Sure, sure. This is the problem, is that, and this is what I really discovered frighteningly as I looked at the Gilded Age. The Gilded Age phenomenon, which was acute systemic corruption, was almost identical, not only under both political parties in the United States, but under every different political system that existed in the industrialized world. So you had it in Imperial Germany, you had it in the French Republic, which is arguably, I mean, not officially socialist, but certainly more socialist. In fact, you had better social legislation in Imperial Germany than you did in the United States. And you had it in the British monarchy, you know, constitutional monarchy, and in the United States. And so the problem is, I don't think there's any system that intrinsically in and of itself can protect against systemic corruption. It means it's sort of like what Benjamin Franklin is supposed to have said upon departing the Constitutional Convention. You know, what are you doing in there? What are you making in there? A republic, madam, if you can keep it.
Right.
The responsibility for retaining integrity in public life and a government in the public interest lies with us, you know, lies with all of us. And what I have also found interesting is how effectively kleptocratic networks secure enablers. Now, they're the for-profit facilitators like real estate agents and law firms and stuff like that. But I mean the enablers. I mean the comfortable people with $150,000 salaries in universities and think tanks and stuff like that who take money from these kleptocrats, you know, from arguably corrupt institutions and individuals. And, you know, they continue to, you know, write boring papers about corruption that no one's going to read. And, you know, I mean, they check the boxes, but fundamentally they are not going to upset the apple cart. And more than that, they don't even understand how this works. So I often get pushback on this description of networks from people that I would expect to, you know, greet this analysis favorably. But it's much more comfortable for them to think that what is the current state of the political economy in the United States is the result, number one, of, you know, impersonal economic forces and, you know, quote, the hurly-burly of politics or some evil other party, you know, that, okay, all the evil is on the other side of the aisle. Those three narratives are comfortable. The narrative that, no, networks of nameable individuals mounted a deliberate campaign to get us here. And, oh, by the way, your salary, you know, you're kind of in receipt of stolen goods because your comfortable salary or mine in the past, you know, was somewhat predicated on this business model, including philanthropy. Where philanthropy is not only image laundering, it's also a way of silencing those who get the money.
Right, right. And we've talked quite a bit about that in terms of the nature of philanthropy and how problematic it is in that respect. So we don't have too much time. I wanted to talk to, you know, like we just saw Donald Trump's corruption in terms of, let's say, just the election and how this aggregates on some level. The idea that, like, you know, Hakeem Jeffries, number three in the Democratic caucus, the other day said, we're not going to look backwards. We're only going to look forwards. And to me, that just sort of feels like, that Petri dish, we're just going to put a little bit more moisture in there and, not deal with that. And just, we're just going to go forward. Meanwhile, the Petri dish, you know, it develops, I don't know science well enough to know, but things grow.
Something grows. And, something grows.
But so with that understanding and the end of your book, or I should say, or close to it, like what has to happen? Because in the past, it has been multiple world wars and a historical depression that created the social cohesion that allowed for the crushing of that, those corruptive networks. Do we need to wait for that? Or I'm not saying wait's probably the wrong word, but is that what it's going to take?
I mean, this was what sent my hair straight up on end as I was doing the research, is we are on such a similar trajectory to the extended Gilded Age, you know, to the United States in the very late 19th and early 20th centuries. And like us today, they had a series of calamities. So have we, you know, we had the savings and loan crisis, and then we had the dot-com crisis, and then we had, you know, the wars, and then we had 2008. And, you know, so it's like this dirge. And as you say, you know, it took two world wars, that's two genocides, mass starvation in Europe, a pandemic, like 10 times the size of this one, the nuclear bomb, you know, and a worldwide depression. And so for me, the urgency of the message that I'm trying to put out is, can't we find that solidarity? Is that the word you used?
Cohesion.
Cohesion. In the fight to ward off that level of calamity you know, can we find almost the same level of cohesion that you would living through a calamity and apply it to the fight to ward them off? For the moment, I have to be honest, I don't see it. And largely, I see that we are still way more activated by any issue that touches on an identity grouping, be it our gender, be it our race, be it, you know, our national origin. Those are the issues that get people out into the street. I don't see us doing a good job of creating a cross-cutting coalition that will hold our own elected officials to account and will demand the specific types of reforms. So both prosecution, and I agree with your suggestion that if people are not punished, there's no line in the sand anymore. It doesn't matter what you have in the, what laws you have in the books, if people aren't punished for violating them. So sorry that it would have to be this, it, you know, an administration of a given party, but then hold people of the other party to the same standards. People need to get punished. We need to call for it. But I think there's a lot we can do in our everyday lives that has to do with, for example, buying local, break up the monopolies ourselves. You know, anyway, as you say, I have an epilogue that is full of things that people can do, because I think it's going to take all of us with all of our different gifts in this fight to the hilt.
Sarah Chase, the book is On Corruption in America, What's at Stake. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Be right back. Finish up the program. Back. So folks, Georgia tonight obviously is the on everybody's mind. Is that a song?
Georgia on My Mind by Charles. Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head.
Look at that. Wow, I had no idea. I had no idea. It just occurred to me as I said that. It really is a big deal, and I suspect there are places where you can still make phone calls. I think I tweeted out something yesterday, so folks can check my Twitter feed for that if you want to make some last-minute phone calls. And I suspect we will also know the results, unless it's super, super close, which could be by, I don't know, 8, 9 p.m. tonight. But it could be one of those things that drags out for a couple of days. We will be here tomorrow to talk about it, and Emma and I will be we'll hop on maybe
tonight
on a little live stream just to recap it. Until then, we will see you tomorrow, unless of course you are staying with us. And remember, you can also if you missed any part of this show today, you can always see it on the Peacock app, the on the Choice channel on the Peacock app, 5 p.m. 10 p.m. we rerun this specific program. And then you can also go back a couple of days, and if you just search Cedar or Majority Report, I think you should be fine there. But interesting, I just found that fascinating.
Great interview. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I should say we just got an IM, and I'll just read this, and I'm not going to read any other IMs in this part of the show. But Sweater Vest Daddy says it doesn't matter how much you root corruption out of capitalism, the effects of capitalism being the upward redistribution of wealth will always just breed more corruption because money is power under capitalism. And I think you'd have to, I think there are other, I think that is true, but I don't know. I mean, I guess from the perspective of, from her perspective, that it is money that exclusively, that in our society creates, status and power, and therefore, breeds corruption in that way. But in other systems, you can be greedy for that power. And, I think I am of the mind, and I think this is, I am of the mind that this form of greed exists either for money, which brings you power, and, or for just other things that give you power within a context of a society. I mean, I think this level of.
Well, yeah, the will to power has been marked before capitalism existed.
Exactly. And, that's what I found interesting about her starting in Anatolia and, you know, ancient, the Persian
antiquity. Yeah.
Antiquity, etc. So, folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is our members who really, you know, keep the show trucking along. Also, subscribe to our YouTube thing now that we're, you know, we got a million. Probably won't push it again until we get up to like 2 million. So, 10 years, maybe another 10 years. But subscribe, just this have me, you know, emphasize that and encourage that for the next decade subscribe. Or so. Yes. Also, check out the AM Quickie. You can find it at amquickie.com. Great way to get 7 minutes of, news. It's in your, you can find it on your podcast, server, or you can find it on, YouTube. That could be, Sam from Vermont says, great interview, Sam. Save that one for the year's beat of.
And then corrected himself twice. Best of.
Oh, best of. There you go. Save, okay. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Unfortunate. Almost unfortunate.
Nomi, are you there?
I'm here. Hang on. Can't control this thing, can we? When are we ever going to become experts at Zoom? That's what I want to know. All right. Hi. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Naomi.
Seamless.
There you go. Yes. What's happening today on your show?
We have an incredible show. It's our first show back from New Year's. For our panel, we have Joshua Kahn Russell and Napoleon DeLegend. And for our main interview, we have Grafton Tanner, who's the author of The Circle of the Snake, Nostalgia and Utopia in the Age of Big Tech, which is, I think, extremely relevant for the moment that we're living in, with Google unionizing and the insanity online. So I'm excited. And of course, our book club just started. So go check out our book club at patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. We are well into our first book, did our first interview with Harvey Kay. It is the story of Thomas Paine. It's a fascinating book. Like, it blew me away to hear his track from, I mean, he came to America when he was 37 years old and within 2 years called for a revolution, which happened, of course. So it's an amazing life story.
That's pretty good. 24 months. Folks, don't forget.
Not 2 weeks. Sorry.
Patreon.com/TheAntifada. You can check out also The Antifada is doing now. Jamie's got two Twitch streams. I think it's on Wednesday and Friday nights, but you can check it out at twitch.tv/TheAntifada. What else am I? Oh, Matt, what's happening on the Matlack Media Empire?
Yeah, Left Reckoning leaves soft launch mode on Thursday night, so look forward to that at 7 Eastern on YouTube, the Left Reckoning Twitch or YouTube feed. And also, I'm going to be Twitch streaming tonight, but check my YouTube Twitter feed to figure out which, if it's going to be on Left Reckoning or Literary Hangover. And also, there's a new Literary Hangover episode over break, so check that out, folks.
Wow, geez, Matt, giving us competition.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Notice. All right, folks, we're going to Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll see you in the fun half.
It might take a-
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.